The book is called Saigon Kids, An American Military Brat Comes of Age in 1960s Vietnam. We have the author with us this morning, Les Arbuckle. Les, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So you were a military brat prior to getting to Vietnam, Saigon, Vietnam. Where did your father's career take you at that point?
Well, we had been living in Pensacola, Florida, and the Navy found out that my father had radio experience as a jazz disc jockey, and he had also studied at the NBC radio school in New York. And they transferred him to Vietnam, where he arrived at the Rex Hotel in downtown Saigon, set up all the equipment, and ran the radio station alone for about 3 months before Lieutenant Keitley showed up. And he was basically Armed Forces Radio Saigon for the first 3 months. After that, they had they started adding various disc jockeys and announcers, one of which in 1966, after we had left, was Pat Sajak. And then, of course, Adrian Cronauer came along around 1965. He later wrote Good Morning Vietnam. And the show he did, you know, Robin Williams portrayed Adrian Cronauer. Right. The show they did was my father's show, the Dawn Busters show, which he had started when he got there in 1962. So I suspect that my dad was probably the first one to say, Good morning, Vietnam.
That's kind of unique. What was, just for on a side note related to that, the purpose of bringing Armed Forces Radio to the region at that point, just to boost morale, provide information to soldiers there? Is that really the main focus for Armed Forces Radio at that time?
Yes, actually, the increasing military presence, American military presence in Saigon, required that they have a radio station to bring news from home. The newspapers usually, they had the Observer and the Stars and Stripes, which provided some news. But it not only provided news, but also music. And there was no TV in Saigon. So if you were an American living in Saigon, you lived for that radio to give you news of home and the music and of the era.
According to the book, initially your father was going to be stationed in, I think, Puerto Rico, if I believe correctly, and then it was switched over to Saigon, Vietnam. And I think the response that you and your family outside your father's, where's Vietnam? What is Vietnam? What did you know of that time when this word came up? Because we think of Vietnam, looking back now, we know what that means, or the phrase, or the place. But in 1962, take us back to that moment when you learned where you'd be
going.
Well,
at that time, no map I had ever seen had a country called Vietnam. It was called French Indochina. And Vietnam was a new word to me. It was not yet something that had pierced the American consciousness, except in, you know, the Pentagon and the halls of the White House. So we were kind of mystified. We looked up French Indochina on the map, and my mother, well, she didn't have a heart attack, but she wasn't happy.
So then once you go there, tell us a little bit about that experience. I mean, you're what, 14 years old, so you're kind of like not under your mother's apron strings, and you're yet not a man on his own. You're kind of in that, as the phrase of the book says, coming of age. Talk a little bit about what you were expecting and then, you know, how your time went there.
Well, I was 13 and a half years old when I arrived, and I was a rebellious young teenager who wanted to find out for himself what the world was all about. I really didn't know what to expect. I had seen the movie, as I say in the book, The World of Susie Wong, and I thought, well, if it's like that, it couldn't be too bad. Right. And then we got there, and we were out in the suburbs, you know, dusty, hot suburb, about 3 or 4 miles from downtown Saigon. And after a while, after about 6 or 8 months, we moved to downtown, 2 blocks from the presidential palace. But for me, it was a wicked case of cultural vertigo, being taken from a dull, sleepy suburb in Pensacola, Florida, to a city of 2 million people in Asia. And we, unlike most military brats, we didn't live on the base. There was no base. So we lived downtown amongst the people, and as soon as you walked out the front door, you were surrounded by Vietnam and the culture and the food and the violence and the political chaos at all times. So it was a nerve-wracking experience for my mother and probably for my father. For me, you know, when you're 13 and a half, you're invulnerable and immortal. You're going to live forever. And I didn't really think about the danger very much, but I know my mother did.
Well, let's take us back now. You decide to write a memoir, a book on this. You and two other brothers were down there with you, right? You had two brothers?
Right. My two younger brothers. My older brother, Lee, got left in the United States because he was too old to go over. He was 18 and no longer a dependent unless he was in college, which there was no college in Vietnam he could attend. So he got to stay behind. He had a job as a disc jockey at WBSR in Pensacola, Florida. So he was pretty much all set with living on his own. But unlike today, communication with him from Vietnam was done by letter. So we didn't see him again for close to 4 years.
Wow.
Because after that, we were transferred to Los Angeles.
So let's take your memories the same as your brother's memories. Everybody kind of goes through life with their own kind of filter of what they see, what they remember. Talk a little bit about some of the things that are in here that kind of, you know, as you look back writing it, thinking, oh, I got to remember this particular incident, or this is something that really impacted, maybe even shaped your life.
Well, I did talk to my brothers about it because I didn't remember who was at home when the coup d'etat started. And who wasn't? And after I talked to them about it, I actually rewrote that chapter to reflect what actually happened. But I just didn't remember.
Well, how can you remember when you have mortars and everything, and you're just hiding and trying to make it stop, I guess, is the question.
Well, yeah, I remembered a lot about the coup, especially when the gunfire broke out, you know, like 50 yards in front of me. That's kind of hard to forget, you know, especially when you're 13 and you're not a soldier. So I remembered that, but I didn't remember that my brother Lynn was out in Cholon at his friend David Fu's house. And my little brother Lowell was home, and Lowell was the only one that knew where David Fu lived. So my father, because he had a press pass, got in the car with Lowell as the coup was going on and drove to Cholon and picked up Lynn because my mother was basically freaking out about it. But one of the things that inspired me to write this is that the only thing I've ever seen hit the shelves at Barnes & Noble's that talked about military brats was Mary Edwards Wirth's book called Life Inside the Fortress, which was about military brats. But that wasn't really a memoir. There are no military brat memoirs that have hit the shelves at Barnes and Nobles. There's a few you can find at Amazon.com, but they're all self-published affairs and they don't get a whole lot of publicity. So I thought I had a unique story, and I thought military brats might want to hear it. I know as soon as I saw Mary Edwards Wirth's book, I ran out and bought it because it's the only thing I had ever seen written about military brats, which comprise 10 to 15 million people in the United States.
I would say you're sort of a small group, but not really in a sense, because for the largest of the people in the military, they have, you know, extended families, the children that are all part of this. But it's, I guess, a certain kinship maybe you have with others. But tell me a little bit about going through those early years. You had a lot of experience. You're what, 9,700 and some miles away from
right.
the United States, but yet you still feeling like an American? Are you assimilating to the culture? What was that like?
We didn't really assimilate to the culture much because we didn't have to. We were not there to live for any longer than the assignment. So we sought out our own culture as much as possible, but that wasn't really that easy. We had the bowling alley and the theater and AFRS, but for the American kids there, there was no TV. So our desire to mingle with our own people, so to speak, was a little more intense than it would have been in the United States. So as soon as school was over, we only went to school 4 hours a day. As soon as school was over, of course, we'd go home, drop our books, jump in a cab and go to the bowling alley or go down to the pool halls and shoot pool or go out and get in trouble. You know, there's plenty of things to do. You do learn a lot about the culture just from being there. But we weren't immigrants, so we weren't trying to assimilate the way an immigrant might.
Right.
We learned to speak a little bit of Vietnamese, a lot of French, and we mixed those together when communicating, you know, with the local people as they did with us. So we learned to speak a language comprised of all three languages and whatever common words we could find.
What was your experience, you know, after you came back to the States, the way Vietnam ended up, how it progressed, what we kind of see on the history books from it? Whenever you see any of that, even like the PBS Ken Burns documentary that's coming, that they have out now, do you look at it through a different filter because of your experience, your time spent there?
A little bit. It's a little more personal, you know. Especially in episode two of the documentary, he covered most of the time I was there, 1963, and just looking at it, you remember just how chaotic it was. It was just constant chaos and turmoil and violence and suffering. It was just nonstop. And we got used to going around demonstrations. I actually got involved in a demonstration. My father, you probably read about that, but it was right there in our face. There was no military base to protect us. So if you left the house, you got what the Vietnamese got and the Chinese and the French people that were still living there. That's what you got. Everything that happened to them basically happened to us.
Did you have a lot of feeling of danger, or were you felt more protected just because of why you were there, or you know, because your father's there, that type of a thing?
Well, yeah, we started to feel the danger, especially when they started. When we first got there, the attacks by the Viet Cong were always directed towards military and diplomatic personnel. And then in, I think it was February of 1964, they bombed the American theater. They had tried to do it before, but it didn't work out so well. But this time it did work out for well. The Viet Cong dropped 20 pounds of explosive in the lobby. I was on my way to the theater at that time, and my brothers Lynn and Lowell had just come home from the theater after seeing the same movie, which was The List of Adrian Messenger. And I heard the explosion and got out of the cab I was in and waited. My father showed up a few minutes later at the house and had to immediately go back to the radio station to deal with all the news coming in. But at that time, that's when we started to feel the danger. My friend in the book, her name is Beverly, was injured in the blast. She was with Marie, who was another person in the book. Three people were killed and 40 or 50 were injured. And that's when we really started to feel like, well, you know, they're after all of us now. It's not just the military personnel.
Did you understand the politics of it? Even as a teenager, I'm thinking sometimes you're thinking, what is all this about? You know, because your life is, you try to, it's sort of a smaller bubble that you're kind of just focusing on getting through the day and who likes me, who doesn't like me. Did you understand maybe even the politics of what was going on at that time?
To an extent, we did. We were in the middle of the Cold War there, and communism was the big evil we were fighting, so we understood that part of it. But the local politics were easy to figure out, even if you didn't think or talk about the politics at all. All you had to do was leave the house and see all the banners and all the Buddhist demonstrations. And it was, you know, I found out right away that Ngo Dinh Diem had been persecuting the Buddhists. Probably not a good idea in a country that was 80% Buddhist. But nevertheless, he thought they were in league with the Viet Cong, which they really weren't, and was persecuting them by prohibiting them from celebrating holidays. And then there was a massacre up in Hue, and the chaos and turmoil at that time was more from the conflict with the Buddhists and the Ngo Dinh Diem government than it was with the Viet Cong.
We're talking today with Les Arbuckle. The book is Saigon Kids, an American military brat comes of age in 1960s Vietnam. You can't have comes of age in it without having a chapter dedicated to sex education, but I like the fact that this is one of the few books you'll actually find a chapter called Sax Education. If you could tell us a little bit about that story, because that really impacted, I guess, your life as it is today, too.
Well, I had started playing saxophone a little bit when we were in Pensacola. And when we got to Vietnam, I couldn't rent a saxophone. I didn't own one. But my friend, Bob, who's known in the book as Bob, his father had a saxophone that he had played in college and wasn't using, so Bob arranged to let me borrow it. And I played in the band there. And then when I moved to Los Angeles, I continued to play. When I moved to Norfolk, Virginia, after that, I actually started working professionally. And by the time I got out of high school, I was working as much as I possibly could, usually anywhere from 5 to 7 nights a week. So Vietnam was the first gig I had ever played, and I still remember the tunes we played, Tequila and Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom White. And I'm still in touch with some of the people that that played in that band called The Esquires. It was a very, very clever name. And it was my first exposure, and I thought, you know, this is something I like to do, and then I discovered I could make money at it. So that pretty much sealed the deal.
Right. I wonder if even if with through Army Brats, because of sometimes the travel, you know, the fact that you move from place to place, you almost have to come up with your own amusement in a sense, and I wonder if a lot of them have adapted musical instruments as something to fill the time in between when they're getting to know people.
Well yeah, that was something also. Music was something. I couldn't take my friends with me, but I could take music with me. So playing the saxophone, I played in Saigon. I played when we got to Los Angeles. I played in Norfolk, Virginia. And even though I had to leave all my friends behind, at least I had the comfort of taking that with me wherever we went. I couldn't really take sports with me so much because sports were different wherever we went. In Los Angeles, I was a gymnast. But when we moved to Norfolk, Virginia, there was no gym class like that, no gymnastics program, so that kind of put an end to that career or any thoughts of that career. So music I could take anywhere, still can.
Talk a little bit about, you mentioned in here, you were in Saigon at the time when the Kennedy assassination took place. Everybody who was living at that time has sort of a memory of a unique one. What was your experience during that time?
Well, we had the night of his assassination. Well, I say night; it was night there when it happened. We had me and my friends had stayed out all night, and there was this soldier who we used to buy cigarettes from, who you could call him gay or a pedophile or whatever you want, but he had a thing for young boys, which most of us did not get involved in, but my best friend did get involved in. But we were over at his apartment and came downstairs at about 7 in the morning and heard on the news that Kennedy had been assassinated. And I thought, well, you know, as bad as that was, it's got to make things worse here. Things were bad enough here. And it did make things worse there.
When you had to leave, what was that like for you?
I didn't want to leave. Okay. I had a lot of friends there, and I was enjoying myself in spite of the danger. And, you know, the community there, you know, of American teenagers was such that no matter how you dressed, you felt like you were a part of the community. Whereas when I got to Southern California, the San Fernando Valley, I didn't dress like anybody there. I didn't look like anybody there. I didn't even feel like anybody there. I felt as foreign to the San Fernando Valley as I felt when I arrived in Saigon in 1963. It was another cultural shock. You know, San Fernando Valley, a very dull suburb. Most of the kids there had, you know, when you told them you had just lived in Vietnam, they look at you like you were crazy. You know, Vietnam, where's that? Never heard of it. Right. And all of a sudden, it's appearing on the nightly news.
Right. Any thought about going back for a visit or anything like that? Or did you do any of that as far as, you know, research?
I haven't. Some of my friends have gone back. I haven't done that. I know it'll be completely different. There were 2 million people when I was there. Now there's around 10 million. And a lot of the old buildings that well, for instance, our old house on Fond and Fung Street is gone and have been replaced by tall apartment buildings. It's still crowded with motorcycles and motorcycles outside of the city, motorbikes, and crossing the street is still dangerous. So I imagine a lot of things have remained the same, but a lot of things are different.
Besides your memories, anything you still have with you that you kept, either some, or maybe there's a, you know, a smell or some sort of words or language or a person's, you know, a face in somebody that you'd see that kind of takes you back to that time?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I walk past a Vietnamese nail parlor, I used to go to downtown Saigon, to Chinatown, that have a lot of Vietnamese nail parlors. Walking past a Vietnamese nail parlor, this really takes me back. People say, you know, you must love the Vietnamese food. We never ate Vietnamese food. We ate Chinese food because the Vietnamese didn't boil the water or chlorinate it. And if you ate the Vietnamese food there, chances are you would get dysentery immediately.
The name of the book is Saigon Kids, An American Military Brat Comes of Age in 1960s Vietnam. Our guest today has been Les Arbuckle. Les, thanks for your time today.
Great. Thanks for having me on anytime.